filtering in. So, good morning.
Good morning.
If you would, get your tactics books and open up to page 142. 142. So, we're just having some discussion. Are you going to teach the 12th?
I will talk to you later.
Okay. So, we're going to do two more studies here. We're going to do this study and then a final study next week. And we'll be finishing the summer series here on the tactics curriculum and developing a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions. It's interesting. These videos online have not gotten maybe the number of views that some of the videos that we do typically do. But the people that have listened have had a very favorable reaction to this way of kind of going about things. I've heard from at least two or three people who have written me and asked, you know, where they can get the material from. One of them's a pastor in Minnesota who has some interest in kind of going through some similar things with people in his church. So it's definitely been interesting. We got this one and then one more and then we're going to be done. Fred has just volunteered to teach. He is going to teach, what would you say, Fred, the last two Sundays in August and the first Sunday in September, right? So we will have class those weeks. Fred has presented me some material that he wants to talk about. So he's going to be presenting that over a three-week period as we run up to the resuming of the class on the Bible, which will happen on the 9th of September. Okay, so just kind of be aware of what that schedule looks like. As of right now, I have one Sunday, the 12th, that is unspoken for. So if you're interested, let me know. We can have a conversation about bringing a lesson. So we're going to get right into the tactic this week that Kukul's going to talk about is taking the roof off. Okay, this is chapter 10. So all these tactics are slightly different, and if you haven't figured it out yet, he's got all these like titles that he's come up with to try to explain them and keep them straight and really make them clear, for lack of a better term. So look at page 142. Before we actually get to the video, I want to just read a couple things together here out of the book. Okay. So, chapter 10, page 142. Some points of view, if taken seriously, don't actually commit suicide. So if you remember, last Sunday we looked at those fatal views, right? We looked at sibling rivalry, infanticide, we looked at formal suicide, and then we looked at practical suicide, and those arguments that self-destruct for various reasons, and we talked about that last time. So this time, this tactic is talking about something slightly different. He says, some points of view if taken seriously don't actually commit suicide, but they work against themselves in a different way. When played out consistently, they lead to unusual, even absurd conclusions. To understand how this works, you might think of maps and highways. If you were visiting Los Angeles and wanted to go to Santa Barbara up the coast, someone might draw a map to guide you to your destination. If, however, you followed the instructions very carefully and took the highway they suggested, but found yourself in Riverside on your way to the desert, you would know something was wrong with the route you had been given. So in other words, you want to end up here, but you're ending up somewhere else, right? You're ending up over here. You're not where you really want to be, right? If, in similar fashion, worldviews are like maps, they are someone's idea of what the world is like. The individual ideas making up a worldview are like highways leading to different destinations. If you use the map but arrive at a strange destination, either part of the map is inaccurate, the part about the highway you were driving on, or the map itself is wrong for, the map itself is wrong for the region. I think I made a comment, I don't remember if it was last Sunday or two Sundays ago, about how people rely on GPS now. And they don't really even use maps. There are people I know that argue that there's no need to even teach people anymore how to read maps, which I think is absurd, personally. Okay, I think that's ridiculous that you wouldn't teach kids skills with how to read a map and orient themselves and this kind of a thing, right?
I realize that this last option is not likely when you're talking about real maps. I doubt if you would try to find your way around New York using a map of Chicago. But this kind of thing happens all the time with worldviews. Sometimes the roads are wrong on otherwise good worldview maps. At other times, worldview maps are completely inadequate for the actual terrain. Keep this illustration in mind as we explore our next tactic. It is a method that helps you determine the accuracy of someone's map to reality, their worldview, by noting where the route on the map leads them. And then he's got the cutout there. He says, if you help someone see in advance that their route that the route his map recommends will actually lead him off the cliff, he might consider changing his course. He might even discover he is using the wrong worldview map altogether and exchange it for one that is more reliable. Okay? So the taking the roof off tactic is going to be about helping people identify these inconsistencies in worldviews that will lead them in the wrong direction. Okay? So in other words, there's a problem along those lines. So we're going to get to the video here, and he's going to kind of talk about this a little bit more specifically, and then there's a few spots again where I'll stop it and we'll talk about questions or comments.
Well, welcome back to our tactics training. I'm Greg Hochul from Standard Reason. This is our fifth time together. And what we've covered up to this session is we've talked about the entire game plan, the Columbo tactic, using questions to maneuver in conversations. We also talked about one way to use questions is to exploit a weakness or a flaw. And so last time around, we looked at a particular tactic called the suicide tactic that can be used in that way. We talked about suicidal views express contradictory concepts, therefore they kind of self-destruct. They aren't things that you have to work too hard on. You just have to recognize it and point it out, okay? We also talked about how you recognize when someone's point of view does self-destruct. You identify the basic premise or the basic conviction or claim, and that's not always obvious, so spend some time reflecting on it. Next, you ask, does the claim apply to itself? Okay? And if it does apply to itself, does it refute itself? And if it does, then you find a way to demonstrate that by using a question to point it out. The third thing we did last time around is we took some popular examples of self-refuting claims. We played them out a little bit. They were experiences that I've had in conversations with other people. And then at the end, we talked about a specific species of suicide that I call sibling rivalry suicide. And simply put, this is where a pair of objections are in conflict with each other. And at least one of them's got to go. And if you can demonstrate the conflict, the rivalry between these siblings, then the person that you're talking with might let one go, and it makes your job a lot easier. Now, here's what I'd like to do today. I want to tell you about the very first tactic that I ever learned. It's called taking the roof off. And I didn't know about tactics at the time, but it's something I learned from the late Francis Schaeffer, who used it to great effect. What I'm going to do this session is show you what taking the roof off is. I'll show you how to recognize the circumstances where you can use this tactic. I'll talk a little bit about why this tactic works, and there's a very particular reason for it. And finally, I'm going to give you some specific examples of popular ideas that will basically lead you over a cliff if you follow them, and that's kind of the idea here. And then I'll show you how you can take the roof off with them. It's very flexible, and it's something I think that you'll find useful in your arsenal of tactics. Now, sometimes when you press a view to its logical conclusions, the results turn out to be kind of absurd. You might think of when Jesus was talking with the Pharisees, and the Pharisees told Jesus, you're casting out demons by the ruler of demons. So what did Jesus do when he was confronted with that challenge? He said this. He said, that would mean that Satan is casting out Satan, right? And Satan would be working against himself. And a house divided against itself couldn't stand. And therefore, this was implicit. Therefore, he was not casting out demons by the power of Satan, but by the hand of God. So he looked at their point of view and their argument, and he showed how it led to an absurd consequence. He was taking the roof off, basically. And that's what you're doing when you use this tactic. You're reducing a person's point of view to its most basic level. You want to simplify it, at least so it's clear in your own mind. All right, and this is a step that I've mentioned a number of times before with all of these tactics. Many times the issue is clouded by a bunch of language, and you have to pay attention. Use your Columbo questions if necessary to figure out exactly what the claim is. Once you've got the claim in view, then you can use other tactics to determine whether it commits suicide, like we talked about last time, or whether it's leads to an absurd result, giving you an opportunity to take the roof off, okay? And what we're going to do is you do that analysis, you figure out what the main thing is, and then mentally you kind of give it a test drive. You think, well, look, if we accept that as true and we keep moving forward with it, does it take us to any absurd places? So for the sake of argument, we're going to treat it as if it were true, then we're going to test drive it and see if, following the logical consequences, the route leads you over a cliff. And if it does, there's probably something wrong with where you started in the first place. Okay, so that's the basic idea here. Now, the point of this tactic is to see if a person can really live with the moral or intellectual consequences of his beliefs, because they can be applied in different ways. And in essence, what you're doing is you're taking their moral or rational views seriously. And then you're showing them that if they're applied consistently, they're going to lead to something that's either absurd for an intellectual issue or for a moral issue, just clearly immoral. Okay, that's taking the roof off. The tactic is also known as reductio ad absurdum, or simply reductio to make it short. That is, you're taking the point of view and you are reducing it to its absurd conclusion or consequence. What this shows, though, is that some points of view that people hold simply prove too much if you take them seriously. Remember, in the very first session, I talked to you about the witch in Wisconsin. And in my series of questions there, when she said that abortion, baby killing, is appropriate in the case of incest, I asked her a question that stopped her in her tracks. Do you remember what that question was? Yeah, I asked her, if I had a 2-year-old that was standing next to me who had been conceived by incest, then on your view, I should be allowed to kill this baby. Is that right? There is my application. I took her point of view. I gave it a test drive. I saw where it landed. This is disastrous. It would lead to infanticide, affirming infanticide. And so then I just used questions to kind of make that point with her. At that particular point, I was using the taking the roof off tactic with the witch in Wisconsin. All right, let me explain why this tactic is so powerful. Francis Schaeffer, who developed...
All right, before we get into that part, do we have any questions about the basic premise of this? Okay, so in taking the roof off, you, number one, reduce a position to its most basic level. Now, you might have to ask some questions and use some of the Columbo's questioning strategies to really get to that point, but then what you do is you test drive the idea with somebody to see where it leads. Okay, so you're saying this. Yes, I'm saying this. Well, if I take that out to its logical conclusion, then are you gonna say this too? Well, no, I'm not gonna say that. Right? So you test drive it to see where it leads, and if it leads to catastrophe, you point out the problem, right? And so you're working within the framework of what they say they believe. You test drive it, you see where it leads, and if it doesn't lead anywhere good, you point out the problem of it and say, is this really where you want to be? Well, no, that's not really where I want to be. So then, what's the problem here? Well, maybe we need to go all the way back to the beginning and figure out if your first assumptions, your first statements are true or not, okay? So this is kind of the basic premise of what he's talking about when he's talking about taking the roof off, all right? Does anybody have any questions or comments about that? It's a tactic and it will work. Now, what he's going to do here in the next segment is explain why it works
this tactic, and gave it its name, taking the roof off, observed something about the human condition. He said, look, given that Christianity is actually true, that means that every human being really is made in the image of God. Every human being must live in the world that God created. And it turns out if that person denies God or denies anything about the truth about God and his world, essentially anything about the Christian worldview, then he's denying reality in some sense. And there's something we know about reality. The real world that we live in, if you don't take it seriously, it has a way of getting your attention. You run into it. You have a collision with it. It may injure you if you don't take it seriously. Well, take that step just a little further. If you are denying some fact of reality, some fact of the Christian worldview, then your belief, it contrary to the Christian worldview, is a denial of reality, and you're going to have there's going to be a collision between what the false worldview dictates and the way the world actually is. Okay, now Francis Schaeffer called this the point of tension. Now, last session, I mentioned something about Richard Dawkins and how, on the one hand, he's a relativist. He doesn't believe in objective morality because he's a naturalist, a materialist. He's an atheist. He understands that if there is no God, then there can't be any morality. But then, at the same time, he's attacking the God of the Bible in one of his books as being wicked and immoral. Now, you can't have both things. This is a sibling rivalry we talked about. But why is it that he makes this mistake? He makes this mistake because, on the one hand, he's a rebel against God, and he wants to say the things consistent with his rebellious worldview. But on the other hand, he's a human being who lives in God's world, and God's world is absolutely thick with morality. And so he can't keep himself from making moral judgments, which he ends up making against God, and which I don't think apply to God properly. He's mistaken in that regard, but he is not mistaken in making moral judgments, because that's part of the real world that we live in. Now, what happens with non-believers who do this kind of thing is that they've kind of erected a protective roof over themselves. The roof protects them from the tension, from the consequences of their own idea, because Richard Dawkins would have to look at something like gay bashing, which he thinks is terrible, and I do as well, and he'd have to say that there's no moral content to that at all. So he just avoids looking at that natural consequence of his view, and that's the roof that protects him. Okay? Our job, Francis Schaeffer said, is to take the roof off. And we do it in a gracious way, but we try to make that person face the consequences of his own view. Now, I mentioned Richard Dawkins, the atheist, because atheism, I think, has lots of these kinds of examples in it, these kinds of collisions with reality. And what you'll notice, by the way, with atheists is when they collide with reality, that is, they run into something in the real world that doesn't fit their worldview, they just call it an illusion. So morality is an illusion. Consciousness is an illusion. Design is an illusion. These are the kind of things they say because they are denying those things that will not fit in the box of their worldview. So what happens if you have a moral relativist? Someone says there is no objective morality. So how do we take the roof off on a person like that? I heard one person suggest steal the stereo. Says there's no morality? All right, steal a stereo. What's his complaint going to be? You did something wrong? Stealing is wrong? You can't say that. So what we're doing in that simple act, and now I'm not telling you to steal anything, but you see the contrast, you see the conflict. In that simple attempt or that simple act, you are demonstrating that the person doesn't really believe what he says he believes. No, they want to talk about relativism when it's convenient for them, but in the real world, in day-to-day interactions, they're moral realists. They believe in.
So I've used this illustration before, but I've told the story of the girl who wrote me the philosophy paper, arguing that all morality is completely subjective and that there is no absolute truth and that you should be able to do whatever you want. So I took her paper and I wrote F. I don't like black ink, and gave it back to her. Okay. Now, what was her response? She she blew a gasket, right? I mean, she was so mad. And I just kind of let her do her thing for a little bit. And then I asked, when she, it seemed like she was calming down, I just said, "Are you done now?" She said, "Well, I guess." And I'm like, "Well, can, based upon what you've argued in this paper, can you explain to me how I've treated you unfairly?" And of course, well, I didn't really give her an F. I'd given her, you know, the grade that she had earned based upon the writing requirements of the assignment. But it was a moment where here she is saying this thing, but I know she doesn't... So in her mind, she says this, so she's protected herself under this what roof, right? And in reality, though, she knows, and I know, that she doesn't really mean that, because I could do 100 different things that are probably going to upset her, and she's going to say it's not fair. Well, if there's no objective morality, like he's bringing out here, then how have I treated her unfairly by giving her an F for not liking black ink? So, in other words, it all breaks down, right? So you identify what's going on, you test drive the idea, and then you point it out. This is the taking the roof off tactic, helping them face the consequence of their own view. Okay?
Objective morality, and their reactions are going to show that. And what you want to do is, given that we know that deep down inside they believe in moral reality, that the human beings made the image of God and they must live in God's world, we're going to try to construct some kind of situation that forces them to face the facts. That's how you take the roof off. And if you can use questions in the process, all the better. What about, let's say, naturalistic Darwinian evolution? So this is part of the atheist package. Now, I think Darwinian evolution fails on the merits, but there are other problems with it. And that is, if Darwinism is true, then put simply, the only rule that matters in the world is that the strong rule the weak. Not that the strong should care for the weak. That's a moral principle. There are no moral principles. No objective moral principles in evolution. And there is just this principle of the strong ruling the weak. So
I want to point something out about that. So according to evolution, if I'm a hungry lion stalking the gazelle herd for dinner, what lion am I going to go after? I'm going to go after the oldest one, the youngest one, the weakest one, the sickest one. Right? I'm going to go after the one that is going to cause me to expend the least amount of time, energy, and effort to get it. Right? And meanwhile, the rest of them, the fittest and the strongest, they what? They survive. They run away from me and they live another day until they're old and sick and weak, and then I can eat them. Right? Okay, you get the point of evolution, right? So have you ever seen in the gazelle herd the strongest, fittest gazelle turn around and come back and mourn and weep over the one that just died? No, because it's that sort of brutish and nasty if that's the way you want to have it, right? So what he's pointing out here is, if this is the way you really think it is, then you have to consistently view it this way all the way through. If you at any time think, well, no, it's now the job of the strongest to protect the weak, well, where exactly does that premise come from based upon the way the system is set up to function? The only way you're going to get that is if there's some other intelligence that is setting that up, right? So what he's going to point out here is, if you're going to take this and test drive it, the pure application of this is going to lead every evolutionist off a cliff when it comes to fundamental basic reality and morality. Does that make sense?
A person is holding to Darwinism, then I think it's fair to ask this question. So here comes Columbo. Tell me your principled objection to genocide. Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, I mean, between the two of them, we've got pretty close to 100 million lives taken. So much for the old canard that it's religion that causes most bloodshed in the world. No, it isn't. It's secular ideologies, for example, communism, which has atheism as its foundation. And they believe in the Darwinian model. And the Darwinian model says the strong rule the weak. And that's what they're doing. They're the strong ones. They're ruling the weak ones. Who's to complain? Now, I know that atheists don't think that's right. My question is, what is their principled argument against it, given their worldview? And the answer is, there is no principled argument against it, given their worldview. What have I done? I've taken the roof off, and I've let the cold wind blow. So they have to feel the force of the consequence of their worldview. They know that in the real world, there's terrible evil. They don't want to admit it quite like that, in so many words, especially when they're defending turf. And when they're advancing atheism, they're going to deny objective morality, okay? You take the roof off in that situation. Sam Harris is another new atheist, and Sam Harris, this is really amazing to me. But he's not alone in this. Sam Harris is a determinist, and what a determinist is a person who believes that the whole world, the whole universe, every single thing is just a complicated set of dominoes falling. All of the choices we make, all the things that we believe, are all determined by the physical circumstances that come before him. Now, why does he believe this? Because he's an atheistic naturalist. He believes in the material world. There can't be anything like free will because you cannot get free will from a materialistic world. So at this particular point, Sam Harris is consistent with his worldview. But you take it a little further, and you're going to have some real problems. For example, if determinism is true, you can't have any morality. You can't have people that are praised for good things they do or blamed for bad things that they do, because praise and blame don't work in a world where there is no good or bad. Everything's already determined by the circumstances that come before, so there are no choices to be made. So how is it that Sam Harris then can talk about morality? Worse, how can he even argue in favor of atheism or Darwinism or even determinism? Because to argue in favor of something presumes that you have the freedom of choice to assess the argument and come to a conclusion based on the evidence. But if
so, what he's talking about is scientific determinism. It's the idea that everything that a human being and human beings are just a think of everything around us as like a wheel, and all the different, you know, spokes or whatever that are in this wheel, right? So all of nature, human beings, and all everything is just some part of this wheel that's spinning, and everything that happens is determined by cause and effect, and that you really are not free in any choice that you make. That's basically what Sam Harris is arguing for, right? So he's pointing out that if that's true, then why do I care about morality at all? And why bother even arguing for the merits of atheism and determinism versus, say, Christianity or free will, if everything is already predetermined by this mechanistic system of nature that is just doing its thing? Okay? Put your hand up.
Yes. Right. The major problem, I think he points out, is that if that's true, everything we do is what they often call a conditioned response.
Yep.
So if I don't have free will, I only react to things happening to me. I never act independently. So the problem with that is if I never choose to do anything, how do I know that? If every thought I have is a conditioned response, then how would I ever know it is?
Yes, so that's going back to more of what we talked about last week on the. So for example, if I decide that I'm going to kick David in the shin, right? So I come over here and I kick David in the shin. According to this view, why did I kick him in the shin? Not because I chose to kick him in the shin, but because of conditions outside of my control caused me to have an inner bodily and brain state that caused me to do what? kick him in the shin. But I'm not really responsible for kicking him in the shin because this is all determined. This is all foisted upon me by conditions outside of my control. So therefore, it's determined that I would what? Kick him in the shin. That's essentially what this is. What Nate's going a step further than that and basically saying, the notion that led to me to kick him in the shin, that even that wasn't even a free thought according to this view. That's what you're getting at, right? Was there another part of it?
Well, yeah. So when he, like you said, when he argues for this position, that argument is a conditioned response, which means we can put no faith that it's true or not true. There is no truth value to it because we would never know.
So when Sam Harris is arguing for this view, it's determined that he's arguing for this view.
Right, and we can never assess the truth value of it.
Right.
Determinism is true. You don't come to any conclusions. You just believe what you're determined to believe because of the physical circumstances before you. That is, Sam Harris has a couple of different points of view that cannot coexist. This is another example of sibling rivalry. And we take the roof off and we show them, your worldview can only give you these goods and no more. And if that is a little painful, sorry about that. Now, if you want this other stuff, if you want morality, if you want free will, if you want rationality, the only place you're going to get that is from our worldview, not from yours. And what you've been doing is you've been living on borrowed capital, basically. You've been stealing from us. So you take the roof off and show them where their worldview leads. Remember, you take their point of view seriously for the sake of argument. You give it a test drive mentally. You see where it leads, and then you just point that out. And if you can use questions to do so, all the better. I had a conversation on the radio once with somebody called in about the issue of homosexuality. Actually, he was gay himself. And as he's trying to justify his own point of view, he said, well, I was born that way. Okay, now you've heard this before. Let me just tell you, as an aside, no one was born that way. There's not a shred of evidence for this. And everybody in the business, in the scientific business of assessing this question, knows it. There's no debate about this, and the twin studies have proved this conclusively. Okay, even people who are gay or gay-friendly who are doing the research, they all acknowledge that there is no physical basis, no genetic basis for homosexuality. They all know this. You'll never hear this on CNN, but this is a fact. Okay, still people will say, I was born that way. Okay. And there's a principle in play here. The principle, the unspoken principle is, if I was born that way, then it's natural to me, and if it's natural to me, then it must be okay for me. All right. Now that's the part you have to kind of strain out of the statement. You have to break it down to its component parts in your own mind. Okay, this is where he's going to. Now, does this conclusion that is implicit in the I was born that way defense of homosexuality, the conclusion that anything that's natural is moral, does that lead to any bizarre consequences? And the answer is yes, it does. And in fact, I use that on him. I said, let me tell you something. What I want to know is, how would you respond if I said this to you? Now I said to him, I don't believe this, but how would you respond if I said it to you? If I said I had a condition that I've had all my life, ever since I was a younger child, I was aware of this. And now I'm using the language that was perfectly parallel with his own description of his developing same-sex attraction. And but then I tell him what my natural impulse actually is. I have a natural impulse to beat up homosexuals when I meet them. So what think you? What say you about that? Apparently he didn't hear the part where I said, I don't believe that. And so he got really mad at me. And I said, look at Marty, that was his name. I'm not advancing that view. What I want to know is, what is your objection to my view in light of what you told me was a defense for your own view? That's all I'm asking. So what am I doing? I'm taking the roof off. I'm showing, if this is your morality, that what just doing what comes naturally is therefore moral, then any kind of vice that I can claim is natural for me turns out not to be a vice at all, even something like gay bashing. That's a problem. Okay. Actually, when you think about it, the difference between just doing what comes naturally and principled self-restraint is called civilization, okay? Animals do what comes naturally. Human beings, by contrast...
Just doing what comes naturally can also be argued to be sin, right?
...are supposed to take their behaviors captive, if you will, to moral realities. We don't do our natural impulses. We say no to them because a lot of them are vices, not virtues. And therefore, this cannot be a good defense for homosexuality, okay? We learn that by taking the roof off. A number of years ago in the state of California, there was a criminal that was going to be executed, and Mother Teresa, when she was still alive, of course, contacted the governor of the state of California and was trying to get the prisoner's sentence commuted. And here is her logic. She said Jesus would forgive. Now, would Jesus forgive? Well, yeah, if the person is repentant and turns to Christ for forgiveness, yeah, Jesus would forgive even a gross murderer. But is this a good argument for the governor to commute the sentence? And the answer is no, and because the rationale or point of view proves too much. So what is the point of view? The point of view is that wherever Jesus would forgive, we should not punish. Okay? But what would Jesus forgive? He'd forgive everything if we ask for forgiveness. So this becomes an argument not against capital punishment, but an argument against all punishment of any kind. Again, it proves too much. Now, I think that God has his court and man has his court. And the court that man has is one that God has given to him. And therefore, God can do what he wants in his court, but man has to do what is appropriate in that court environment. And forgiving every criminal is not appropriate, even though Jesus would do it. How do we know it's not appropriate? Because we take the roof off. And following that rule would mean we'd have to end the prison system entirely. Okay? Now, how about the person who says, well, I'm not hurting somebody, okay? A lot of times in moral issues, you'd be talking about these things, trying to make a case about something, and they'll say, well, I'm not hurting anybody, so therefore my morality is okay. That's the implicit conclusion, all right? I remember having a conversation at a wedding, and we were all at the dinner table, and there was an attorney sitting across from me, a young lady who is not a Christian, and this point came up, and I said to you, so you must have been really upset when they prosecuted that doctor who molested that woman while she was under sedation. And she said, no, I thought that was terrible. And I said, well, wait a minute. He wasn't hurting anyone. So in that situation, her moral rule was fulfilled, but it was obvious that this person was doing something that they shouldn't have been doing. Think of a peeping Tom, for goodness sake. Why is that illegal? They're not hurting anybody. And in fact, people who are being peeped on don't even know they've been peeped on much of the time. So where's the harm in that? Well, it turns out, just by reflecting on those illustrations as I take the roof off, this would be the consequence, that morality has got to be much broader than simply the rule do no harm, as long as I'm not hurting someone. No, there's a lot more to morality than that. And therefore, simply arguing that I'm not hurting anybody is not enough justification to be able to allow you to do whatever it is you want to do. Okay? In the real world, morality is much bigger than this kind of thing. All right? That's the point of tension, by the way. The person wants to limit morality to this particular thing because it's comfortable for them and maybe justifies their own views, but at the same time, they have to live in God's world. And there are plenty of counterexamples that are clearly wrong to them that do not fall under that heading as long as I'm not hurting someone. We talked about another example in another session when a student says there is no truth And we talked about that being self-refuting. You could ask them, really, is that true? But you could also ask another question that would be an example of taking the roof off. This idea that there's no truth, almost universally in my experience, comes from students. So when they go to college, this is what they learn. They learn there is no truth. And that strikes me as a little bit odd. Isn't going to the university the place where you're supposed to learn what is true and gain knowledge, whatever? So if that's what they're learning, what are they doing at the university? And that's what I ask. If you don't believe there's truth, then what are you doing here at the university? Is this what your professors are teaching you? There's no truth? You should ask for your money back. The fact is, in the real world, there is truth, and we can know it. Indeed, we are truth seekers by nature. This is the way we're made. We're made in the image of God. We live in the world that God has made. And deep down inside, people know these things to be so, these things that they're trying to deny for other reasons. What we do is we take their point of view, we give it a test drive, and we see where it leads. That's taking the roof off. So that's what we've done so far in this session. We learned the basic tactic, taking the roof off. We learned the three steps that you need to take in order to use the tactic. You reduce the point of view to its basic premise, and then you adopt it as true for the sake of discussion. Let's say you're right about that, okay? If you're right about that, then where does it go? And then we reflect on where it goes. And if it turns out, when we give it a test drive, when we force the person to face the logical consequences of their view, if it turns out to take you over a cliff, if it turns out to be absurd or obviously immoral in the case of moral issues, then we know that the starting place is probably a bad starting place. And we want them to consider maybe adopting a new starting place. Something must be wrong with the view that you began with that leads to this end. That's reductio, the reductio ad absurdum. That's taking the roof off. We also learn why this tactic works, and I've mentioned it many times to reinforce the notion. It works because God actually exists. Human beings live in the world that God made. They're made in the image of God, and they cannot get away from that. And every person who denies any of those facts or any facts related to that are going to have to live in a way that contradicts some aspect of reality. And that's the tension. The way they believe the world is and the way the world actually is, that's the point of tension Schaefer talked about, that we can, if we're watching for it, we can exploit it. And people have tried to protect themselves by erecting a kind of roof to protect them from their self-deception, to shield them from the logical implications of their beliefs, and they're not willing to follow those out. Okay, well, this is what we do. Gently but firmly, we take the roof off, we try to deprive them of their false sense of security, and we show them where their view actually leads, okay? And we always use what? Questions whenever we can. So here's your homework. I want you to be alert this week to points of view that might lead to absurd conclusions if they're practiced consistently. And again, take the other person's point of view, reduce it to its basic premise, give it a mental test drive, see where it might go. And maybe you'll find out that it leads them over a cliff or into a ditch. Then you come back and you take the roof off and you help them to see the consequences of their wrong viewpoint.
If anybody have any questions or comments about that, I want to end by going to page 152. So it's no secret to most of you that I've been doing a lot of reading and research and thinking about things related to the English Bible and the King James and so forth. And there's a position, I'm going to use this as an illustration of what he's talking about. There's a position out there that's called the pure Cambridge position. Okay? And what the pure Cambridge position teaches is that if you want the perfect Word of God, you need to get a circa 1900 Cambridge edition. Okay? This is the one that has everything every word spelled correctly, every punctuation mark in the right spot, everything is pristinely perfect. In the circa 1900 Cambridge edition, this is the perfect one. Okay? Now, okay, so let's test drive that. What if I have a King James Bible that's not a circa 1900 Cambridge edition? Does that mean I don't have the perfect Word of God? According to them. Okay, how many people, if you take the percentage of people worldwide who are King James Bible believers, that percentage of people means how many of those people, which are a clear minority, how many of those people have a circa 1900 Cambridge edition? Not very many. So does that mean they don't have the perfect Word of God? According to this, right? So that means if I go to a bookstore and I want to buy a King James Bible and they don't have the circa 1900 Cambridge edition, does that mean I don't even have God's perfect Word available to me to buy if I don't have it on the shelf as an option to buy?
According to them.
Okay, and more than that, what if I lived before 1900? Does that mean I'm just, well, out of luck because I lived before the one that was printed, I got everything perfect? Okay, so understand, a view like this comes from the right heart and the right motivation to want to have God's perfect Word, right? But the problem is, it ultimately goes too far. It excludes anyone before and puts into serious jeopardy anybody after whether or not they have the right one or not. Okay? Now, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about taking the roof off. Facing the consequence of the view. The consequence of this view is not helpful to me as a King James advocate. In fact, I think it's detrimental and does more harm to my position as a King James advocate than it does help. But there are people that are willing to throw down over this. Or intellectually throw down over whether or not you have the circa 1900 edition. Okay? This is an example to me of, okay, identifying the position, test driving it, see where it goes, and say, is that really what you want to say? Because I think it's not, right, in the end. So let's look at page 152 and 153 as we wrap this up. So, faith versus facts, bottom of page 152. Some people think that facts and knowledge make faith impossible. The reasoning goes like this. Hebrews 11:6 says that without faith it's impossible to please God. Faith is believing things we cannot know. Faith and knowledge, then, are at opposite ends of the spectrum. The more facts we have, the less room there is for faith. God is most pleased, then, when we cling faithfully to our convictions in spite of the evidence against them. Okay? If this is your view, following this route will lead you into a spiritual ditch. First, apologetics, giving evidence in defense of the truth, must or would be misguided. This is scripturally absurd. Peter says we should always be ready to make an apologia, a defense for our hope, 1 Peter 3:15. And Jesus and the apostles gave evidence regularly. And I might add, Paul himself says that he's set for the defense and confirmation of what? The gospel, right? Second, if knowledge and faith are inversely proportional, i.e., as knowledge decreases, faith increases, the more evidence we find against Christianity, the better. Our knowledge would shrink to nothing, providing ample opportunity for an abundance of blind faith. Indeed, affirming something you knew to be false would be then of the greatest virtue. If you took this view, God would be most pleased with those who had every reason to know the resurrection never happened. For example, yet still believe. The Apostle Paul, however, called such a person pitiful. If Christ be not raised, your faith is also vain. So in other words, that's the exact argument, right? Well, if it takes the most faith for me to believe this and it's counter to fact, that Paul says that's crazy because what you believe about the resurrection is in line with what? The facts and what actually occurred and what actually happened, right? According to Paul, if we believe contrary to fact, we believe in vain. We are not heroes to be praised, but fools to be pitied. What has gone wrong here? The problem is with the premise. Faith is believing things you cannot know. This is not a biblical understanding of faith. Faith and knowledge are not opposites in Scripture. They are companions. How many times does Paul pray that you be increased in the knowledge of His what? Of His will, right? They are companions. The opposite of faith is not fact, but unbelief. The opposite of knowledge is ignorance. Neither is a virtue of Christianity. Okay? So, this is our tactic, taking the roof off. And hopefully you can see some applications for it. You can see how it works. Again, it's reducing something to its most basic level, taking it for a test drive to see where it leads, and then pointing out the problem. And I use this thing about the Pure Cambridge circa 1900 as just an example of okay, let's drive that out. Let's get in that car. Let's drive that. Let's assume that's true, and let's see where that leads. And it seems to me that it leads to some pretty interesting things that I don't think you want to be arguing for as an advocate of the King James Bible. Okay, so that's just an example of what we're talking about. Next Sunday, we'll look at steamroller. Steamroller is the last lesson in the video curriculum here, and I might also touch on the end about a few highlights from these last three chapters about Rhodes Scholar, just the facts, and more sweat, less blood. Okay, so whatever happens next week, we'll kind of wrap this up and we'll go on from there. Okay? Thanks for your attention.